to show you.
Welcome to the 40th episode of the Sirens of Scream, the geek podcast that proves sometimes dead is better. I'm your host, Jackie DeVore, and I'm joined by my co-host, Sierra Halk.
Hello.
And Melissa Megan.
Hi there.
Today, we're welcoming back one of our favorite horror lovers, June Gregory.
Glad to be back with you
to
guys.
We're going to talk about the mystery that is the Winchester House. So, June, let's start out with you. We haven't heard from you in a little bit, so... is there anything you've seen or are looking forward to coming up in 2018 or anything you want to recommend to us here?
There are some good haunted house things coming out. The first of these, oh, yeah? I don't have an exact date for it, but I do know that Netflix has made a miniseries adaptation of Shirley Jackson's The Haunting of Hill House, which, as we talked about in a podcast before, was influential for many haunted house films, and there were, I think, two direct adaptations. It might be a good time to go ahead and read that novel if you haven't checked it out, from 1959. It really is iconic haunted house literature. And I did read one article, which I put in my further interest links, that suggests that the Netflix series is going to deviate quite a bit from her novels. So I don't know how I feel about that, but it'll be fun to compare and contrast.
Right on.
The next thing on my list, I am just very excited about. I don't know if you guys remember a young adult novel. It was written, actually, I think in 73. John Bellairs wrote it, and it was illustrated by Edward Gorey, you know, the guy with the spooky people, and all the kitty cats and stuff. But it's called The House with the Clock in Its Walls. And the story had very much a Harry Potter kind of feel. There's a really neat house. There's witches and wizards. Some of them are good. Some of them are bad. And there's a doomsday machine built into it. This is going to be a really funny movie. I think it's rated, actually, I'm not sure the rating on that. Eli Roth is going to direct it. It'll be out September 21st. And the cast includes Kate Blanchett, Jack Black, and most excitingly of all, Kyle MacLachlan. So if you're missing him after Twin Peaks.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, exactly. And he's kind of a Severus Snape type of character. So,
dang.
Yeah, and then the final one of these, just a little mention, there's a really good haunted house book that came out in 2009, Sarah Waters' The Little Stranger. I think the British film is going to be out August 31st, and it takes place in the late 1940s. And the book is really good, so the film sounds promising. One tiny little note, something I learned today, Gary Oldman is going to be in a film called Mary about a haunted boat.
Huh. A haunted
like
boat?
The Queen Mary?
I don't think... from what I get, the idea, it is more of like a private vessel.
Oh,
but evidently, if you take it out into private waters, it shares some secrets with you. I'm interested.
Oh.
Yes. And Gary Oldman, so.
Yeah. Cool, cool. Melissa, how about you?
So I've seen a couple of movies since we last did this that I want to talk about. I'm going to quickly, briefly mention Gerald's Game, which I know we referred to on our Stephen King episode, but I think at that point, I don't remember if anybody else had watched it.
No, I think Jacob had. That was
okay.
It.
Okay, finally watched it, and this is it's a Stephen King adaptation. It's a story of a couple who go to a remote lake house and decide to try to revive their marriage by trying some kinky handcuff play in the bedroom.
How's that work out for them?
It doesn't work out very well. Things go bad pretty quickly, and it's a psychological thriller is what it is, and I don't know, I thought it was really interesting. I actually enjoyed it more than I expected to, and I like that the film sort of gave you something to figure out in the end. You know, I like when everything's not kind of completely cut and dry.
You know, I damn near clicked on that on Netflix just last night.
It's interesting. I'm not crazy about the ending, I will say. I think the ending could have been done a little bit better, but the actual film is really intriguing, and it's quite an emotional roller coaster. I will say, trigger warning definitely needs to be stated before this. There is some really intense references to sexual abuse in here. So, yeah.
That's good to know.
Yeah, that's it.
I love the book and the film. I mean, I agree it needed a trigger warning.
Yeah, it's pretty rough at times, but I also thought it was really well done. I mean, Carla Gugino is the star of this, and I think she's great. So yeah,
the name sounds familiar.
She's gorgeous.
She was in a lot of stuff.
Yeah,
late 90s.
She's been around for a long time, and she's still gorgeous. It's ridiculous. She's one of those people that doesn't seem to be aging.
Isn't that just unfair?
It's totally unfair, especially since I was just complaining that I hurt everywhere from doing like 30 minutes of yoga. So the other one I watched, just last night, we watched one that keeps popping up on my Netflix called Before I Wake.
Oh yeah, I keep hearing that one's good. What do you think of it?
Well, this was released a few years ago. It's actually a 2016 film outside of the US, but it was just now released in the US through Netflix. So I thought it was pretty good. It's very quiet, and it's a very slow moving film, especially for kind of a supernatural horror film. I think this one also could use a little bit of a trigger warning. There's child death involved here, which is really, really hard for me. But I was so creeped out by what was happening that I didn't really focus too much on that.
That's good.
Some of the visual effects, like the ghost kind of supernatural effects in this, I thought were really cool and really impressive.
Nice.
About a young couple who lose their child very young, and they decide to try fostering a young boy who's been kind of shuffled around to different homes. And you know that never goes well. Like, we've all seen multiple horror films about an adopted child. I feel like the horror genre is just like not good to help any kids get adopted. This also has Thomas Jane, who we talked about in 1922, the other Stephen King adaptation.
Who is definitely a real
person. He's a real person.
I've decided.
And he has shaggiest hair I've ever seen on a man in a film in this. His hair is a mess through the entire film. Kate Bosworth is also in this. Annabeth Gish. I will say I wasn't super impressed with the young boy, the child actor that's at the center of this. Mm-hmm. He just sort of spent the movie kind of like whispering and whimpering.
Gotcha.
But it's creepy as hell. I was really upset because Ryan fell asleep like a quarter of the way into it. So I had to watch it by myself, and I was so freaked out. Like, I wanted you to watch this with me and protect me. Just like over there snoring. No, it's really creepy. It's definitely worth checking out. A good kind of like, you know, silly, just supernatural like creeper.
Nice.
And then we finally saw The Shape of Water today.
Yay.
Ooh. I've been dying to see this, like dying, but we couldn't get a freaking babysitter. So we had to wait until a day that both of us were off work and sent our kid off to school and went to see the movie together. And it was fun. Yeah, I felt like such an old fart because, you know, we went to like the Monday matinee and we were literally the only people in the theater, I think, under like 60.
That's honestly kind of the best.
It was pretty funny. Yeah.
I feel like June and I have done that a couple times, haven't we?
I think so.
It was pretty funny. There was at least one or two phones that went off with like, you know, long melodic ringtones that like I just wanted to get up and be like, can I please help you find your phone? Where is it? And Ryan, the little old lady sitting next to Ryan, was like narrating the entire film. She's like,
it's
one of them. Oh, look at what he's doing. She's like, oh my god.
Oh god.
But no, it's fantastic.
I feel like I heard somewhere that the actress, and this is just anecdotal, but the actress may have had wrote the short story.
I read tons of trivia on this on the way home because that's what we like to do when we love a film. We just read all the trivia.
Yeah,
of course.
Yeah.
No, Sally Hawkins is the main actress in this.
Okay.
And apparently Guillermo del Toro wrote this several years ago and he wrote it with her in mind and like in this part. He said she was the only person that he imagined in this part.
Aww.
That's interesting. Sweet.
Yeah, and of course, Doug Jones plays the sea creature who's done a lot of work for Guillermo del Toro.
Doug Jones is so incredible.
He's like the actor that nobody
he
knows.
He can literally morph into anything.
But they've seen him in a million things.
But is everything.
Like unsung hero.
So if you don't know the premise of this, without spoiling anything, it's basically the story of it takes place in the 1960s. 1962 in Baltimore. It's about a woman who's a janitor at a government facility, high security facility, and she is has to clean the room where this humanoid amphibian creature is being held by some very mean men who are poking at him and being terrible to him. And she falls in love with this creature and decides that she wants to rescue him.
Cool.
Yeah, it's a beautiful film, first of all, but it's Guillermo del Toro, so like you shouldn't expect anything less than gorgeous.
Yeah, seriously.
Absolutely gorgeous. It's really interesting because it's a love story, but it is very like Creature from the Blue Lagoon so it's very like, I mean, he's not a pretty creature, you know? He's like slimy and he's got like kind of scary spikes and he's got these big giant claws, and it's really, I was super, super impressed with the makeup in this. Like the creature is, every time you look at him, there's like parts of him that are kind of moving and fluttering and like reacting to his emotions and his body. It's really awesome. Incredible. But no, it's a beautiful movie. It's a love story. I wanted to say, one of the things that we had read about in the trivia was that Del Toro was a little frustrated that people were unwilling to call this a horror film. And it was written as an homage to Creature from the Blue Lagoon, who's, you know, one of the original monster movie creatures.
Right.
But I think because there's so much kind of like heart and softness in the center of it. And we've had this conversation a lot on this show, right?
Right. And probably that it has really pretty visuals, mm-hmm. too. Yeah.
But I will tell you something as well, is that what's really interesting about this, and I didn't notice, but in the opening credits, another fantastic actor that's in this is Michael Shannon. And
he's so good at playing a bad guy.
He's so good.
Yeah.
Is he from Boardwalk?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Yes.
Yeah. He's so intense.
Wow. And he kind of plays the same character.
Intense man.
A little bit.
Yeah. So Michael Shannon plays the Colonel Richard Strickland in this, and he's the man who basically captures the creature and brings him back. And he's horrible. He's a horrible person. This movie's not just about the creature. It's about the monstrosity of human, of people, and kind of the things that we do.
How man's always the worst monster.
Yeah, and I didn't realize, but my husband had pointed out to me that at the opening credits, they actually listed Michael Shannon's name next to the word monster. Like, as if he was the creature.
Oh, wow.
I totally missed it. But I was like, oh, it's damn. Yeah, because as you get through it, like, you realize very quickly that he really is a monster. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the creature is something that's actually kind of beautiful.
A slight side note here. Does anybody else think that Michael Shannon kind of looks like if John Mayer got older and went evil?
Yes. I will never not see that.
Oh, my gosh.
True.
I think if you're a fan of the original, you know, creature feature, Blue Lagoon kind of monster, he did a fantastic job of like hearkening that in the costuming. Or the creature from the Black Lagoon. I'm sorry, I keep saying Blue Lagoon. Yeah, there's a lot of things in the costume that you can see that really like pull from that original Black Lagoon creature.
I look forward to seeing the makeup.
It is a beautiful film, and I was a little verklempt. I was a little choked up.
Maybe it sounds like it might be one of those where I might need to kind of casually have a loose sleeve that I can dab my eye with.
Yeah. You'll cry a little bit.
Yeah.
What's the Octavia Spencer's in this too, and she's pretty great.
Oh, I love her.
Yeah. There's so many moments in this movie where Michael Shannon is speaking to those two women who are both janitors, and like, oh, I just want to scream. I just want to like put my fists up there.
Slap him.
Because he's just such an asshole. He finds a way to cut them down for being women, for being janitors, for being everything. He's just constantly cutting at them.
Oh, that's painful.
Yeah. But it's fantastic. And this thing has gotten like an immense amount of nominations, Oscar nominations coming up, so we'll see how that goes. But like, we were reading them on the way back, and I think, let's see, 12 different nominations.
Jeez.
I mean, it's all over the place.
Nice.
We also just saw Paddington 2, which has nothing to do with horror, but I think it's funny because we saw two movies in one weekend for once, and they both starred Sally Hawkins. Totally accidental. Yeah, and I was reading, one of the interesting trivia things was that she said that she had to spend so many hours in the water filming scenes for this film. And the very next day after they wrapped it up, she had to fly to London to work on Paddington, where they decided to film underwater scenes for that immediately on the first day.
Oh, Jesus.
So she was like in the water nonstop. Yeah. So that's it. That's what I got for you.
Nice.
All right.
I'm going to go ahead and get mine out of the way because Sierra's is much longer and I just have one. Mine is an Instagram artist called Hysteria Machine, self-described as a UK-based macabre designer. And if you take a look at the link here, it is extremely ornate pieces, typically tiaras or horns or chest pieces, involving just a lot of little tiny mm-hmm. details and a lot of skulls, a lot of bulbs, a lot of spikes, and it's just incredibly interesting.
Very Baroque.
Yeah. I've seen some of them that have stained glass architecture. I just found about these recently. They are something else.
They're intense, but damn, incredible. I want to know how long it takes her to make one piece, because these are mm-hmm. so
seriously.
Involved.
If I had $1 million.
I'd also like to know how much that costs.
I was going to say, how much is it? And where would you wear one?
Everywhere. If I could buy one of I would wear them everywhere.
Grocery shopping, obviously.
Fucking grocery shopping in the dairy aisle, wearing one of these big ass things, poking so these soccer moms with my giant crown.
So you could just walk down the aisle and put your arms out in front of you, spread. Make way. Make way for the queen of death.
Exactly. Sierra, let's go ahead and move on to you.
I'll start with Nan Lawson. Don't really super think of her as a horror artist, but she does more pop culture stuff. But Jackie and I were just swapping Instagram links a couple days ago of her stuff. And she has Mulder and Scully, which I think we both have a Scully print, which maybe we have the same one.
I think we actually talked about it before, and we have a different one, oddly enough. And she's got a new one, too. So
I have a Shaun of the Dead one and a Dale Cooper one. All hanging in my stairwell.
And I have an Edward Scissorhands one
nice.
Too.
Oh, nice. Yeah. So she has a very distinct kind of illustrative style. She does these portrait busts, and I'm a big fan of her art and her style. And she's also just a very nice person. Whenever I tell her I like something on social media, she's always very sweet about it. But she has a solo show right now at Gallery 1988 down in LA called Meet Cute 2. That's her second solo show. So if you want to hop onto 1988.com, and that's spelled out with all the letters, you can see all of her new work. And I just think she's a very cool person. And she sometimes dips her toe into horror, but it's mostly just pop culture stuff.
Yeah, she's got a really cute Wednesday Addams mm-hmm. one here. And I'm really annoyed I didn't jump on that Audrey and Dale Cooper one before it sold out.
It's very cute. That's first. And then I have another artist that I just recently discovered on Instagram. His handle is SlopJockeyERT, which is hard to say and spell. But his name is Dusty Ray. He's a painter. His work is very, how do you even say it? It's very primal almost. It's a lot of animals, but with weird human scary mouths and scary eyes, some skulls. Ooh.
It feels very visceral.
Absolutely.
Even though there's not much viscera there.
Yeah, it's not overtly gory all the time, but there's a lot of weird mouths and teeth and
I think
very striking
stuff. The right word for it there.
So I keep I found him on a related artist thing on Instagram, and I started following, and then I forgot that I followed, and then it kept popping up in my feed, and I kept being oh my God, I have to talk about this guy because he's so cool. But lots of animal stuff and skulls, and now I want to buy all of his stuff too. He has an Etsy store.
Yeah, it's extremely abstract in a very mm-hmm. cool way.
And then my final thing that I want to talk about this time is a newer podcast called Atlanta Monster. It's the current true crime podcast that everybody's all about right now. It's by the same folks who did Up and Vanished and How Stuff Works. So it's very well produced, very good storytelling. I think the host is a white guy, but it's about in Atlanta in 1979, all of these black children being killed and going missing. So it's very, very, very sad and kind of hard to listen to. I can't listen to more than one episode at a time without needing a break. But it's a very good and important they're telling the story very well by putting together a lot of clips from the news and media at the time, and then having people who lived through it do interviews, and then having like kind of cultural professors type of people talk about like the cultural climate that it happened in, especially in Atlanta, which at the time was like very segregated and it was very like race driven. And there was a lot of like underreporting of stuff because of like who the victims were. But it's just, it's so good, but so hard. I don't think Melissa should listen to it or would be able to because it's a lot of like kids dying and going missing.
You hear that, Melissa?
I do.
But yeah, and it's the like popular one that I keep seeing people talk about in the podcast groups that I follow and things like that. But it's good. It's only 4 episodes in so far, so you can catch up pretty easily. Yep.
Very cool.
Sounds like important history, but maybe taking doses.
Yeah, definitely. It seems like a lot of a big story that wasn't really told or covered at the time. So now it's like nice that they can kind of go back and fill in the blanks and actually explain what was going on and give people a voice to like talk about what happened.
Yeah, that's that's important.
If you guys remember the like on the news, the like it's 10 o'clock, you know where your kids are announcement thing that like became really popular and like that came out of it and it became like a big part of the like vernacular. But yeah, that's where it came from. Yeah,
I had no idea. Well, cool. With that in mind, we're gonna take a short break here and then we're gonna jump right into the Winchester
house. Just moved in my new house today. Moving was hard, but I got squared away. Bell started ringing and chain ran loud. Knew I'd moved in a haunted house. Still I made up my mind to stay. Nothing wasn't gonna drive me away. When I seen something that give me the creep. Had a one big eye and a two big stood right still and I did the freeze. He didn't stroll right up to me. Made a noise with a beat that sound like a drum. Say you be here when the morning comes.
Welcome back. Bullet-laden ghosts, meandering stairways that go nowhere, round-the-clock construction on miss-sized hallways, doors that don't open, and windows that don't look outside. At the center of it all is a cursed and grieving widow who also just happens to be one of the wealthiest women in the world at the time. If that doesn't grab you, how about a fresh new horror movie based on this story starring Helen Mirren? Today, we'll be talking about Sarah Winchester and her mansion of mystery. June, what should we know about this intriguing legend?
Oh man, this story has intrigued me for years. You laid out the basic elements of the myth. I'll go over it again, as the story that I've uncovered is quite different. I also want to talk a little bit about how this house has already, before the film being released, has influenced other books and cinema works in the recent decades.
Yeah.
So they commonly know the story that Sarah L. Winchester, Sarah Lockwood Winchester, is the heiress to the Winchester Repeating Rifle Company fortune, and that she did indeed believe herself to be cursed by the spirits of those who came to death at the end of the Winchester rifle. She had lost her daughter and husband, and this really cemented, and you know, in the story, the idea of her being cursed for some reason. And she consults a cultist or a spiritualist named Adam Coons, who tells her that she is cursed. And this is the result of, you know, the anger of all the people who died because of the Winchester rifle, and that her own death would come when the house that she was building was completed.
Oh, I didn't know that was the pretense there.
Yeah, and Winchester is said to have been a occultist and spiritualist in her own right, who conducted seances in the home that she would build to manage all these ghosts. Well, anyway, after her husband dies, she moves to the Santa Clara Valley of California, or what we now call Silicon Valley, not too far from San Jose, and she purchases a property, a farmhouse that has about 8 rooms already, and starts building onto it. The house has some really weird features, and since the spiritualist had told her that her death would come when construction stopped, construction couldn't ever stop. There was round-the-clock work being done and rooms built for seemingly no reason. you know, the work is 24 hours a day, must not cease. As if all this perpetual carpentry isn't strange enough, the design of the house was that of a crazy person, and the home was disorienting to be in. There were long passageways that didn't seem to go anywhere, staircases that just went into a wall, windows not opening on anything. Sarah did have a lot of architectural knowledge, and she designed and drafted the plans for this house and carried them out, but she made them for the dead, not the living. In the legends, the design of the house is so that spirits couldn't follow her, that they may be confused or even entrapped. The house really is odd looking and has features like a door that, you know, opens out to just a two-story drop. It definitely seems like it might be designed to perplex somebody.
I love the idea of ghosts getting confused by architecture and just like being in a room like, well, what the fuck?
Yeah.
I was following this woman.
There is an ancient belief that if you rearrange things in your house, and you see it across the world and across folklore, that if you change your house around, you know, the boogeyman will have a harder time getting to you. So maybe she was working off of this idea. Also, this, you know, the common legend tells us that Sarah loved the number 13, and she incorporated this number into as many aspects of the building as she could. The house has spider web windows,
which are so cool looking.
They really are. Mm-hmm. It's said, you know, the house is frequently said to be the most haunted in the world, you know, which if it's housing the spirits of everyone killed by the Winchester rifle, that is a significant population of them. Yeah, that's a whole lot of ghosts.
You're talking about moving around and confusing them too. Wasn't there a rumor that she slept in different rooms every night?
Oh, you're so right. Yes. To confuse them. Yes, yeah, she would
That'll
change bedrooms every night is part of the legend. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, she certainly had a lot of rooms to choose from. Mm-hmm. In any case, when she died, I think she was 82 years old. She died in 1922. The construction did stop, but the very next year it was reopened as a tourist attraction. Mm-hmm. So the story is interesting. It touches on two really important elements in American history. The first is, you know, the gun that won the West, the Winchester rifle. No matter how you look at our westward expansion, for good or ill, there certainly was a lot of carnage and genocide. Yeah. It really was a tool of making that frontier. It was everybody's go-to rifle and was advertised as being it's great for shooting down Indians and buffalo.
Yeah.
And spiritualism is an, I think, often underappreciated cultural backbone to a lot of our ideas about the afterlife. A lot of people say that spiritualism went away in the 1920s, but a lot of the books and articles I read working for this project, these historians make a good argument that no, it just became completely mainstream. Mm-hmm. If you think about today, the Blumhouse movies, the Ouija franchise, you can get Ouija leggings and housewares and blankets.
I just bought some last week.
Yes, I want to get too. Exactly. So one thing that I found interesting is that while most ghost stories, you know, the ghost has a clear identity, there is no ghost named in this story. They're just assumed to be just a proliferation of them. And so there's no one story or figure attached to that.
June, when you were looking it up, did you see anybody talk about if Sarah's ghost had shown up at the house after she died?
That's a good question.
I did not.
I think it should.
I know that there's a lot of programs that do like ghost hunting, mm-hmm. and it may be that something like that was discussed, but I did not find that. In fact, I didn't find a ghost of any particular identity at all.
That's weird.
One of the sources that I was reading was pointing out how when you go into the Winchester house, they don't talk about ghost at all, except for it being something that Sarah Winchester was preoccupied about. They really play up how it's just a house of a superstitious lady with funky construction. They really take the ghost out of it and make it more just about a quirky structure. I wonder how that will change after the film and all the people who are going to be pouring in to see this.
Yeah,
that's interesting considering all the, you know, like Hollywood house tours that are focused on whoever was there before and who might still be there, you know? I think ghosts are definitely like a marketing shtick for Hollywood homes.
So absolutely.
I was on the tour website a little bit today, and I guess last year they just added an extended tour. So I wonder if that has some more like in-depth information about the actual like supposed hauntings. The basic tour is about an hour long, and you go through, it's at 110 out of the 160 rooms. And then the Explore More tour is just over 2 hours long, and it lets you see some of the rooms that hadn't been shown before.
What I found interesting in a ridiculous way is that if you Google the Winchester House, one of the first things that comes up is Google reviews about the house.
Oh, really?
And so there are people, so like there are people sitting here, whining about the food in the cafeteria.
Oh, man.
How the price is a little too high. It's like, there are ghosts here, guys. What are you doing?
Something else that I find really interesting about it, too, is the large amount of money that she apparently spent on, like, what do you call it? Colored glass?
Yeah, like stained glass.
Tiffany glass.
Yeah, like Tiffany and Cartier, like all these big companies made this immensely expensive glass for her, and many of them weren't actually installed in the home. They're just kind of piled up in like a big storage room.
There's a lot of beautiful pieces that aren't being installed yet.
I want to see that storage room.
Yes.
There's a picture of it on the tour site, I believe, the storage room, and they've got them like all hanging in between each other in this big giant room.
Well, I predict after the influx of visitors in the coming years that they can afford to do some stuff. I think there is like some museum development that the property owners have completed or are working on. Like, I think they actually built a little museum for the rifles.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so this crazy house has been inspiring some big figures in the horror world. As we discussed, Shirley Jackson, who wrote The Haunting of Hill House, was fascinated by the home. Before she moved she lived very close to the house in San Jose. She asked her parents to send pictures and information about it. And in her iconic book, she does mention the Winchester House. Stephen King came across a Ripley's Believe It or Not comic book in his youth that told a pretty souped up story of the Winchester House, and it just became embedded in his brain and really had an impact on him. I think we can see that in like the haunted house, I think the Marston House and Salem's Lot and in The Shining, but certainly in his 2002 TV miniseries, just called Rose Red. And there was a prequel for that, The Diary of Ellen Rimbauer. And in many ways, this story is patterned off of Winchester. Ellen Rimbauer, the woman of the house, was told by a psychic that she would live as long as she continued to build on the house. And her husband was an oil tycoon. Well, Ellen Rimbauer disappears into the house, I think, in 1950. But as soon as she disappears, the house just starts building itself.
Ooh.
So, yeah, and then there's some references to both Shirley Jackson and the Winchester House in these works. There's also a visual artist named Jeremy Blake who's done some combinations of painting and film photography that are pretty interesting. I think one of his sequences was used for Punch Drunk Love. Anyway, not long before he committed suicide, he did a piece called Winchester Trilogy. And it's a strange blending of images. Some of them are 1950s cowboy cartoons. Some of them are these weird Rorschach-looking tests with weird sounds and kind of creepy and psychedelic. I've put the link on up on our thing if anybody is interested in watching that on YouTube at any point.
Very,
I think,
interesting.
It may have been the last thing that he did before he ended his life at Rockaway Beach.
Huh.
Yeah, so interesting stuff.
I also want to recommend a comic book series before I forget here called House of Penance.
Ooh.
It's published from Dark Horse Comics, and it's got some really, really beautiful artwork that's all colored by Dave Stewart, who's been around forever. And yeah, it's all based on the Winchester House and a whole story about Sarah working away on the stairs and someone who comes to the house to kind of like find out what's happening and sort of get stuck there.
Oh, I can't wait to see this. Yeah.
Yeah, it's great. And it's a complete series, so you can go through and read the whole thing.
So for all the things that the Winchester houses inspire, like, it's kind of surprising there hasn't been a film yet, but how lucky for us that the stars aligned to have Helen Mirren playing this fascinating woman.
Amazing. Yeah.
So I'm feeling really good about it happening now. And I don't know a whole lot about the film. I know it was directed by siblings Michael and Peter Spierig, I believe is how you pronounce their last name, and they're from Australia. Hmm. They're familiar with the horror genre. Among their credits are Daybreakers and Jigsaw. And they also directed a sci-fi film called Predestination, which I've not seen but have heard good things about. Most of the film was filmed in Australia, a little bit in California. Peter Spierig does the soundtrack, which, from what I've seen on the trailer, I do like. I think that'll be a good one. From what I can see watching the two trailers, the whole thing with the number 13 is really played up, mm-hmm. and these ghosts are super angry. And it seems that the house is really being built to maybe imprison these ghosts or manage them somehow.
Oh, okay.
I also get a sense that Sarah's apparent madness is possibly going to be used against her by those who want to take her fortune. Mm. And she keep, you know, there's a lot of her talk about she's going to fiercely protect her family from the ghost, from this curse. I do like that the film seems to regard the fact that Sarah was very close to much of her family. She did indeed have a niece who lived with her, who will be portrayed in the film, Daisy Merriman. And she was almost like a daughter to Sarah. A lot of the Winchester stuff that I read, the myths, you know, say that she just lived in solitude. Well, this isn't true. And the house itself existing and being a tourist attraction really gives weight to the claim on the film's poster, you know, based on true events.
Yeah.
I never questioned any of this till Jackie and I were discussing the film and talking with you guys.
Did you get any of the fun trivia from this movie yet? Because I have a few things to share if you don't have them.
I do not.
So some of the things I found are interesting is that Lionsgate, who did mm-hmm. the film, they actually bought the film and photography rights to the mansion to do the film. So now tourists aren't allowed to take any photos of the interior
really?
Of the mansion.
That's kind of a drag.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
And the promotional image that you see everywhere of Helen Mirren sitting mm-hmm. in the mm-hmm. carriage is a exact kind of reproduction of the only known photograph of Sarah Winchester.
Awesome. Oh, I didn't know it was the only known photograph
on the estate.
Of her.
Yeah, there's like, not. Yeah. And there's a lot of images of her family and, of course, of her husband. But mm-hmm. And I have to say that image, it nailed the little snail curls around her forehead. Loved it.
And Sierra, I think, will find this particularly interesting. There's a world-renowned parapsychologist, paranormal investigator named Christopher Chaikin, who conducted the only scientific experiment of the haunt phenomena of the mansion in the early 1990s, which was sanctioned by the Winchester property owners.
What did he come up with?
Did he?
We want to know what happened. What did he come up with? Where does go?
I don't know. I don't have that much information. And Sarah Winchester was only 4'10", which I also think is interesting for some reason.
She's as big as my grandma.
A tiny little thing.
I wonder what they qualify as scientific, because I know at least Ghost Adventures has done an episode, and I think I'm sure other ghost hunting shows have done it. I don't know. I
think there have been several.
Yeah.
I don't know, but why... While June continues her history lesson on this, I'm going to Google it for you so
Thank
you can see
you.
If I can find a follow-up.
I remember the Ghost Adventures episode was a little underwhelming. Like, they didn't find any super good, quote-unquote, evidence or, like, EVPs or anything that I remember. But they kept getting, like, sick and stuff in the house, which kind of almost feels like the construction was, like, messing with their center of balance or kind of messing with their head in a way that, like, gave them a headache or made them feel nauseous, which makes me wonder how much of it is energy versus how much of it is just, like, optical illusions kind of messing
Perception.
With you. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, the information I have may give some insight.
Oh, cool.
They weren't able to film much at all in the actual
because
mansion
so
for that reason
weird.
Because
yeah.
everything is so cramped.
Yeah.
Yeah, everything's so cramped and squashed together.
I also found more stuff about the, like, specific examples about the number 13 and how it's used in the house. Reading this from Wikipedia and the Winchester's tour site. Many windows have 13 panes. There are 13 bathrooms. and the 13th bathroom had 13 windows in it. Many of the stairways have 13 steps. There are 13 ceiling panels in many of the ceilings. Mrs. Winchester divided her will up into 13 parts when she died, and she signed it 13 times. There was an expensive chandelier imported, and it originally had 12 candle holders. So, of course, they had to add an extra one to make it 13. The drain covers on the sinks have 13 holes. And on Friday the 13th, they have a large bell on the property that they ring 13 times at 1 p.m. or 1300 hours.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
It's a lot of 13s.
That's some dedication there.
It's a neat place, and I've always wanted to go. I haven't been. Man, now that Lionsgate is going to cramp my style, I won't be Instagramming anything, I guess.
But, right.
But I do plan to make that trip, especially if they're opening up more of the house.
Yeah.
And I'm ready to jump into my the true story of
Let's
the
hear
house. Okay. And first, I want to give a shout out to a book that I was going to mention in my recommendations. Chapter 3 pertained to the story of Winchester, but the book itself, which is, I think, an NPR Book of the Year, was just such a good read. And I think you guys, as well as your listeners, might enjoy this. It's written by Colin Dickey, came out in 2016, Penguin Press, New York. It's called Ghostland, An American History and Haunted Places. And it's really entertaining, thought-provoking, informative. It's really tying in American history and history as far as seen in, as our culture and our beliefs and our legal system and how it interacts with ghosts. And it's just, it's a great read.
Huh, highly that does sound really cool.
Yeah. And the other source that I've got to mention, this is a very important one. The majority of what I'm going to be talking about in this section came from this historian. Her work, her name is Mary Jo Ignoffo, I think is how I pronounce her last name. She published in 2010, Captive of the Labyrinth, Sarah L. Winchester, Heiress to the Rifle Fortune. This is the only academic effort ever taken to find out the truth about any of this. The author was in a library researching something else for California history when one of the librarians that she worked with a lot said, "Will you please do a biography about Sarah Winchester? I get asked about it constantly. I don't have good information. I know that there is a lot of information out there. Somebody just needs to deal with it." So, the author took on the task and has uncovered an entirely different story, and it's very well researched and documented. So, had to give this historian a shout out. We owe her a lot. Okay, so
what does she have to say about it?
Yeah, so she is the definitive word. Sarah Pardee is the legal and birth name of Sarah Winchester, but she never went by Sarah. She always went by Sally, or later in life, Aunt Sally. Nobody ever called her Sarah, but for the case of this podcast, we'll certainly keep that. She was born in 1839. She married her neighbor and childhood friend, William Wirt Winchester. Now, he himself was not the big papa of the rifle fortune. That was his father, Oliver. And in fact, during this time, when you know she marries him in 1862, the Winchester fortune didn't come from rifles at all. It came from shirts. They had a big shirt manufacturing plant. The rifles were kind of a side project. Oliver Winchester, the top of the company, really believed that their design for the repeating rifle would do well, and he tried to take it to the government. You need this for the Civil War. It's a good piece. American military didn't buy it, but a lot of overseas purchases. I think Turkey bought quite a bit of the rifles.
That's a hell of a side project.
Indeed. And yeah, the shirts were making all the money initially. So when she married the guy, she didn't think, oh, he's got, you know, this great fortune from rifles. None of that was happening yet. Just had a little money for shirts, or from shirts, rather. She did indeed lose her husband as well as an infant daughter. But contrast to the story that tells, you know, she lost them both and was, you know, and then moved to California. They died like 16, 17 years apart. Her daughter died as a baby in 1866 of a rare illness that prevents the baby from being able to absorb vitamins and produce protein. Very sad. Kind of ironic that a family that could provide so much for a little baby girl was unable to take care of her.
Oh, it's a bummer.
In 1881, her husband went to his grave, tuberculosis complications. So Sarah had already been out west with William to San Francisco, but she decided that she was going to move to the Santa Clara Valley, or what we call the Silicon Valley, and now in 1885. And she found the property that had the 8-room farmhouse and pretty much immediately began to build onto it. Sarah was not somebody who had the time or interest to mingle a lot with her neighbors, and there were attempts. People wanted to get to know her, but she is what I think today we would call an introvert and wasn't particularly interested in that.
And yes, back then they would call them weird.
Yes. She's hysteric.
And I think that this is a good point in the story where she may have been doing herself a little disservice, because not talking to the neighbors at all, it really opened herself up for speculation. And that would only grow as time went on. So Sarah was a really good architect in her own right. She subscribed to lots of journals. She went to observe how homes were being built other places, had a big hand in some of the building of her other homes. And I might point out that Sarah Winchester had a lot of different properties, and none of them were kooky or eccentric. The house in San Jose that we now call the Winchester Mystery House was known to her as, and I may mess up this pronunciation, Llanada Villa, which is something about, I think, house of flat land. And it was just kind of an experimental house for her. She had a lot of money to do architecture, and that was her art. The house was kind of a studio or an experiment in the process. She would build things a lot and tear them down, not, you know, necessarily out of fear of ghosts or needing to get away from them, but just she wanted things to her specifications, and she viewed it as a learning process to build and tear things down. She was skilled, and she went far and wide to world trades and looked at amazing panes of glass and ordered some cool things. The spiderweb windows are magnificent, as far as I can tell.
There's a spiderweb front gate, too, I noticed.
Ooh, nice. And I wonder if there's nothing in any records that talk about an interest in spiders. I wonder if that was a decorational motif that may have been more popular than I realize at the time. Yeah. I don't know, but it certainly is kind of gothic and spooky now. I certainly enjoy it. As to the gun guilt that is associated with Sarah Winchester, her family didn't start getting money from these rifles till close to the end of her husband's life. There's no evidence at all that points that she had any guilt or bad feelings about it. It's interesting to note that all the sources that say that are tabloids, yellow journalism, and they all come about at a time when progressive ideals are really starting to think about the violent consequences of industrialism, and the Winchester repeating arm was something that was often discussed. So as people are beginning to have consciousness of how much destruction can be caused by such a weapon, it's kind of projected onto poor, quiet Sarah Winchester, who wasn't taking the effort to defend herself from these newspaper articles. And
it's
these stories,
sad.
Yeah, it is. All the stories that we have about her with the ghost and the gun guilt are found in newspaper articles, and most of them, the author remains anonymous. Hmm. This is a time when yellow journalism was not regulated very well. She does give evidence that she was a very caring and compassionate woman. The people who worked for her were often generational, you know, had their children living on the property and all had nothing but nice things to say. If an article came out that talked about Sarah being crazy, you know, there was usually an article defending her. People just weren't interested in hearing the defense. They wanted her to be scary and the house to be full of ghosts. I get it.
I know. Yeah. I want it to be full of ghosts.
Yes. And also, you know, she's a woman living alone, and she has financial power and clout. Mm-hmm. And I think that people were put off by that.
Yeah.
So one of the rumors about the house is that construction was nonstop. There is no evidence for that. In fact, there is ample evidence that shows that that was anything but the case. She would take weeks or even full seasons off from construction just to let everybody rest. Huh. And there's the record is full of them taking breaks. And the last 17 years of her life, she was hardly at the house. So there's also that to keep in mind. Another reason that she was an easy target for tabloids and gossip is she didn't come out a lot because she was physically debilitated. She had rheumatoid arthritis that made movement itself very difficult. Some of the stairs in the house are made out of weird narrow little switchbacks, and those were made so that she could just walk up the stairs without being in excruciating pain. Not a ghost trap or anything like that. She also, as she aged, lost a lot of teeth. Efforts to get good dentures and partials were very unsatisfactory. Of course, dentistry in these days was not what it is now. And she was very self-conscious about her teeth, and that was one of the reasons for her wearing the heavy veil around people she didn't know very well.
She sounds like a really tragic figure.
There is a lot of tragic figure here. There is one of the anecdotes I found about her is a politician was trying to claim that, oh, I give wealthy people money and influence. I give Sarah Winchester gives me money and I give her political whatever, just something along that lines. But we have a letter from her where she gives him what for. And she's like, don't think because girl. I am a woman. Don't think because I'm a little old woman that you can get away with doing this for me. I'm so glad you lost because, you know, this is just lies. And she said, so she got him and she seemed... Oh, here's another neat anecdote about Sarah Winchester. A lot of her work crew came from China and Japan, and people had a lot of ugly things to say about this. They said that she held weird rituals with her Japanese gardeners, and you know there was a lot of racism in the area at the time towards Asian Americans, and she didn't care at all if people had things to say about it. And seemed to treat her employees very well.
Yeah, one of the things that I read when looking up info on this was that a reason for the frequent construction was just to provide business opportunities, like just to provide work to carpenters in the area.
Yeah, she's making jobs.
I came across that as well. Yeah, and in fact, that tidbit is sourced. I think a guy did his master's thesis in like the mid-1950s, and that was his conclusion. And what I'm reading about definitely supports that, too. And one of the historians who works at the Mystery House says that she is convinced that's the reason. The current general manager says he doesn't believe in ghosts either, that it may have just been, you know, providing for work. Another theory that I came across in Mary Jo Ignoffo's book is that it may have been a way to keep company from coming by. Oh, you know this house. We're always working on it. Nice. Which I get.
The ultimate introvert.
The ultimate introvert dodge. Yeah, it's which I liked personally. I like to believe that. Somebody who worked for her did say that as she started to become aware of the gossip around, you know, the house and what she was doing, that she was kind of amused by it. She did admit that the house was funny looking and ramshackle. So one of the neat features of the house is that there are windows that have two odd Shakespearean quotes. One is from Troilus and Cressida that says, "Wide unclasp the tables of their thoughts." The other is from Richard II that says, "These same thoughts people this little world." Both are, you know, referring to how burdensome, you know, a person's thoughts can be and the effect they can have on them. And in an interview, Helen Mirren says that of all the things in the house that really may actually tell you what she was really all about, that's the big clue. Mm-hmm. That's the thing to be mulling over. And I really like that and agree with that.
Yeah, that's really cool.
So some of the most bizarre elements of the house have a very scientific cause, and that's the earthquake of 1906 that really devastated San Francisco. Before the disaster, the home was much larger than what you see today, much more to it, and it was a lot higher. It was 7 stories in many places, and it had lots of towers and turrets.
Oh, wow.
Most of those cool towers are gone. And when Sarah saw what her house was like after the damage, she remarked that now it looked like a crazy person had made it. So because you have sections of the house just falling off, Now all of a sudden there's a reason where you have a stairway that just goes to a wall. Because Sarah decides, she was like, you know, after this, I'm not going to build onto this anymore. And an ironic thing that you can find in the paper trail is that when this happened, all of a sudden the papers, instead of ridiculing her for her constant carpentry on the place, said that she was crazy because she was going to abandon work on the place. Everybody in the area at the time was expected to pick up and rebuild. So she was frowned upon for just patching it up and letting it go.
Well, crazy if you do, crazy if you don't.
Yeah, she couldn't win. What's interesting is that in San Jose at the time she lived, there was a whole lot of spiritualism going on. And one of the newspapers that published the most garbage about her, the two men who ran it, their mother was actually a spiritualist who laid hands on people, who had a kooky house, who had seances and had a lot of money. Now, she was much more the real thing, but you never saw anything about her. And evidently, there were quite a few women in the area who had big houses, lived alone, maybe dabbled in seances. But Sarah was the only one who was targeted for gossip. The earliest reports, tabloid stuff, just talks about how superstitious she was, really playing up the story that if the house isn't being worked on, that she'll die. Later, you get into progressive age and the gun guilt story is introduced. Sarah didn't have a big circle, but everybody that knew her defended her with tenacity. All of the elements of the story we know and love, the seances, the ghosts, the gun guilt, they all come from the tabloids. The one thing she did to really influence it was just to have a weird house and not speak to the public. She died in 1922 of tuberculosis. She didn't spend much time in the house the last 17 years of her life. And of all her assets, this home was deemed to be almost worthless. Nobody came forward to buy it. So one guy, a carnival amusement park worker and developer named John H. Brown, made an offer. He said, I can't buy it now, but I can lease it and then buy it shortly after. He didn't even need to see the house. He just made an offer. He had already heard the rumors and knew that he could turn it into a tourist attraction. Yep. Yeah. So in 1923, the next year, it's opened up. One thing I'll have to say about this, for the elements that Brown is about to put in that aren't true, he doesn't call it a ghost house. He called it a mystery house. And the house today seems to hold that tradition of more mystery, what's going on here, less of a, you know, a ghostly thing to it. But he did make alterations to the house that are definitely going to skew the truth of this story. James Perkin was one of Winchester's head carpenters. He saw the house after John H. Brown had done his work on it and said that everything with the number 13, all of those weird details, was absolutely put in after Sarah's death. There had been a lot of changes made to the house. Here's a funny thing. Harry Houdini, who was passionate about debunking spiritualists because he felt that they were preying on grieving people, and rightly so, he amassed many charlatans, but he went to the house, toured it at midnight, loved it. And he actually really helped, you know, give it some credibility.
Interesting.
Yeah. So after she died, many people who knew or tried to set the record straight, it was just to no use. Two brothers who actually provide a lot of the letters and photos that helped to flesh out the real story, they tried very hard, but at the end they were so disheartened that the truth would never win out because people didn't want it. People would rather believe ghost stories that they just gave up. But they made a pact and encouraged others who knew Winchester to not speak to anyone about her or the house because any little detail could be used to further distort the reality of the situation. So Sarah Winchester gave us, whether she knew it or not, quite a ghost story. It's still one of my favorite ghost stories. I do think it's unfortunate that somebody is profiting from making serious changes to the story of her life. I wonder what she would think if she knew now that what was going on. I don't think in her wildest dreams would she have imagined that her life and home would be the subject of a major motion picture, and with one of the world's most revered actresses gorgeously portraying her.
Yeah. That's, I really would love to know what she would think about this
whole
thing. I hope
she'd get a kick out of it.
Wow. Yeah. At the very least, it's an incredibly entertaining story that's been made up here.
It really is. And it introduces, there's a whole new story, just how this whole thing came to be developed and commodified. The carnival huckster guy, John Brown, he really knew what he was doing. And the property is still owned by his descendants. There's a common misconception that it's public property. It is not. But there's no doubt that they will be
getting lots of dough.
getting lots of dough. I must confess to a level of disappointment, but I really think that this film has the potential to be among the greatest ghost movies we've ever seen. I can't wait to see it. I don't think The Truth needs to take the wind out of its sails, but I do think it's important to bear in mind that this woman isn't, you know, what we're being led to believe. She has an interesting story all her own that doesn't necessarily match up with any of this.
Yeah. Yeah. They seem to be taking two very separate paths here, the truth and the made up story, but they are both very intriguing.
Yeah. And, you know, gun violence is very much in our current political conversations.
I wonder if that has anything to do with it being into a movie right now.
I believe so. From what I can see in the trailers, you know, these angry ghosts. Yeah, I absolutely think so.
So you're saying the gun rights people are going to be up in arms over this movie?
Was that pun intentional?
It took me a second, but oh, that was
still
good.
Worked.
Yeah.
It was not, but it still worked. Yes. It was a valid question.
I think that anybody who has strong opinions about firearms in this country that sees this film is going to have some thoughts and probably words.
So I finally found some more information if you guys are interested about this paranormal investigation, which actually was not easy to find. So like I said earlier, Christopher Chacon, not sure if I'm saying his name right, who is a world-renowned parapsychologist, paranormal investigator. He apparently worked on material for Paranormal Activity and Poltergeist.
Oh, nice.
Did the only, quote, scientific investigation of the mansion. It was 30 days of continuous around-the-clock assessment.
Oh, interesting.
Oh, wow, that's
intense.
Yeah.
Yeah. He apparently, like, they used monitoring equipment that was placed at various locations around the mansion, and then they randomly relocated all of the equipment every 72 hours. Let's see. And then there was remote monitoring equipment set up in a mobile lab that was manned 24/7 from outside of the house. The environmental monitoring covered things like temperature, radiation monitoring, air current and air content, electrostatic emissions, electromagnetic spectrum, vibration and movement, air pressure, humidity, and spectrum of light. And some cutting-edge technology they used included third-generation night vision, thermography, and ultrasonic and microwave imaging. This was a very, very thorough.
They're not messing around there.
Yeah. Says they also did a number of blind experiments that involved wiring subjects with remote physiological monitoring to document any subjective experiences of anomalies. Finally, 328 subjects were interviewed. 164 that reported having paranormal experiences on the property. Another 164 subjects that visited the property but reported no experiences. So, the results.
So, like 50-50.
Yeah, exactly. I guess that's where the scientific part comes in. They had a control factor. Of the 720-hour investigation, showed approximately 1,440 total events were documented, averaging 2 per hour. 81% of the events were determined to have explainable factors. However, approximately 19% were found to be anomalous in nature, paranormal, or haunt phenomena, and could not be scientifically explained.
Interesting.
Of the subjects that reported paranormal experience, 71% of their experiences were subjective and could not be objectively corroborated. I won't bore you guys with more details after that, but all different, like, types of hauntings that kind of it's broken down into. Yeah. Which is like intelligent hauntings, residual hauntings, poltergeist hauntings, which I guess encompasses kind of like the type of thing that happens. You know, is it something that's seen? Is it something that's felt? Is it objects that are believed to be moved on their own or changed? It sounds like there wasn't a whole lot found in the end, you know, with 71% of the experiences considered subjective and couldn't be corroborated. That's a lot resting on word of mouth. And people making big claims to things that happened that they couldn't actually prove. So
any of y'all talked to anybody who's been there?
No.
Mm-mm.
I have. Mm-mm. And a few of them said, oh, it felt, you know, haunted, very haunted. But the majority said it just felt crazy, which mm-hmm. is definitely the sense I get, is that the tour guides are, you know, playing up the Winchester had, you know, was convinced there were ghosts versus there's a whole bunch of ghosts in here. So maybe they're, you know, were influenced by that. I think that also the time that the house was built and the fact that things were, you know, there was an earthquake and things were kind of patched up, that probably there's just a lot of elements of the house, low ceilings and angles, that probably really enhance the sense of the uncanny.
Mm-hmm. And just like claustrophobia, even without being aware of it, like that affecting your body, you might think is a ghost or something, but really you're just reacting to the environment.
I mean, just looking at pictures of it.
Yeah.
You know, just looking at photos inside the house can make you feel kind of wobbly. Mm-hmm. And
yeah, the disorienting environment does a lot more than people give it credit for.
To go from like huge tall ceilings with rows and rows of layer upon layer of molding. I don't think I've ever seen so many layers of crown molding and woodwork in one room, to suddenly go to, you know, tiny little staircases that cut off suddenly. I think there's a set of stairs in the house too that was like branched off in three different directions that leads to three different floors.
Ooh, that must be weird.
Right?
Yeah.
Like one set goes up like 7 steps and the other one goes up like 10 or 11 steps. And it was apparently done to as convenience so that the help could get through the house quickly to different floors. But it's got to be weird to walk up like to a landing and then see sets of stairs that go to different floors on each side.
Yeah, from what I've read, the staff needed maps in order to get around easily.
Yeah, I was just going to say, it must have been hard to be day one housekeeper there.
Oh, I can't imagine. No idea where you are. And just imagine seeing the house before the earthquake. I mean, it was 1906, so there wasn't a lot of photography, but the images that I've seen, I mean, just, man, what a shame that we've lost that, because that really would have been mm-hmm. something. 7 stories of it. In any case, it's a great house.
I wonder if they have the floor plan still.
Oh, I believe so.
Like, if it could be recreated. Maybe this movie will make enough money that they'll recreate it.
Yeah, one thing I noticed when looking up details of this is that the tour hours mm-hmm. never say busy. Like, at their height, it says not very busy on Google here. So
interesting. And I think they can leave every 20 minutes. Closed only Christmas.
Well, yeah, it sounds like the house has been struggling in terms of tours and as an attraction lately.
Well, maybe they should play mm-hmm. up that ghost thing a little
sounds
bit.
Like they're going to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I still plan to see it, ghost or not.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm really looking forward to seeing it.
This house also reminded me, this is a little off topic a little bit, but it reminded me of the story of House of Leaves.
Oh, yes.
With like I think, didn't you guys read this with me when we first started the show?
I read it years ago, but I know we
I
talked
Jackie,
about it when we first started.
Yeah,
I'm pretty sure
that.
I gave you that book at some point.
Mm-mm. Yeah. It reminds me of that story of the house kind of constantly changing and morphing.
Yeah.
I wondered about that, and I tried to see if there was any evidence that he was influenced by the house. I didn't find any, but I also thought of 13 Ghosts and that, you know, a house that's designed to be haunted. It's great stuff.
Designed to trap the ghosts, right? Yeah. I think 13 Ghosts was literally designed almost like a prison to hold
the
ghosts.
Yeah, there was a basement.
And trap them.
The cell with all the different.
Yeah.
Oh, and they were some striking ghosts. That was
an unfortunate film, because the effects were so great and the house was so cool to look at, but man, the acting was god awful.
Scooby-Doo remake movie acting.
Yeah.
It was bad.
I've seen it multiple times just to see those ghosts over and over again, but man, the acting is so bad. Like, you can almost watch it on mute and enjoy it more.
I mean, maybe that one can get a redo.
A reboot?
Yeah. I think it was originally a William Castle movie, I think, in the 60s or late 50s. But, yeah.
Yeah, I feel like that is a remake of something. I'm sure Bob will write to us later and let us know.
Yeah. We should have him on again.
Oh, yeah.
And for our listeners, June has a beautifully extensive further reading list here that we'll post with the show notes. June, you're always great about giving us interesting things to look into.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, my pleasure. And I always get great recommendations from y'all.
You know, I saw that Rose Red miniseries, too. And when we did our Stephen King episode, I completely forgot to mention it.
Well, I forget about it a lot, which is funny because it's this, you know, big haunted house thing. But
I remember it being pretty cool. I remember enjoying it quite a bit.
Yeah, the watching it again before this, it really seems old, but it does have
some
hold
up well.
Oh, and you know, it's funny, the cast in it, of course, it's got Nancy Travis, but what is his name? Jimmy Simpson, maybe? He's in Always Sunny in Philadelphia and Westworld. Yeah,
oh, really?
He's in there, as well as Emily Deschanel. I feel like Julian Sands, another old 80s horror actor.
I love
and Nancy
Emily
Travis
Deschanel.
Is, yeah. Emily Travis is, her performance might be problematic. I'd be curious to see what y'all think. A lot of reviews certainly felt so.
Oh, Jimmy Simpson. I know who he is now.
A young...
He's in Westworld now. He's great in Westworld. All right. Well, that's kind of a common thing, I think, with Stephen King miniseries, especially. They don't hold up well over time.
Yeah. I think It is probably the only one. Because I think the Tim Curry counts as a miniseries. I think it was...
Yeah, it was a miniseries. Mm-hmm. And to be honest, I hate the adult acting in that, so...
Oh, man, yeah. Oh.
We know.
Okay.
We were just so bad.
It's pretty bad.
It's pretty bad.
But a young Seth Green. Ugh.
The kids are fantastic in that. All right. Well, any other comments on the mystery or not so mysterious Winchester House here?
As disappointed as I am, I'm very excited to go out on, I think it's the 2nd of this Thursday.
Yeah, February 2nd.
And check it out.
Yeah, this is... This episode should be coming out right as the movie is coming out in the theater, so that'll be good timing.
Oh, so professional.
And the film, it just looks beautiful.
It really does. I'm excited to see it regardless of how true it is.
Mm-hmm.
Well, The Siren to Scream is a member of the Mega Nerd Media family. Visit meganerdmedia.com for geek-related columns, reviews, interviews, and videos. I also want to give a little shout-out to our sound editor, Drew DeVore, who does a great job of making us sound like we know what we're talking about. If you've been enjoying our happy little horror show, please remember to leave us a rating on iTunes, Stitcher, whatever you listen to these things on. This helps us grow our audience so that we can keep doing these cool things, and you should also know that we love being guests on other podcasts. If you have a cast you'd like us to sit in on or a suggestion for us, we are all ears. That also goes for any kind of topics, or if you think that you might be a good guest fit for us, we are also listening there. You can reach us via email at sos@meganerdmedia.com, on Twitter and Tumblr at Siren to Scream. And you can find past episodes, show notes, recommendations, links, and more at sirentoscream.com. June, where can people find you?
Well, I don't have much of an online presence these days, but I can be connected to my Facebook.
You know, I'm just going to set you up a website where you can just, like, go on historical rants and stuff for people to go and look at cool stuff.
I would so follow that blog.
I need something like that. I have an Instagram now, but I've never even posted.
Oh, we have an Instagram now, too.
Yeah,
I found
y'all. I've been doing it.
I just don't. I don't put anything good out there.
We need to put that in our outro here. We now have an Instagram.
You can find June on the Sirens of Screams.
Yes. Yeah,
that you can.
That's right.
Kind of a guest host here at this point.
And I do hope to return soon. It is always a pleasure, and I'll be thinking of some other little facts that the horror fans need to know.
We absolutely love having you on here. You teach us so much. Like, seriously, we get so excited every time you come on here.
Oh.
You're definitely the easiest guest that we have on the show. We're like, we have to put together all of our stuff. No, June's going to have so much for us.
Oh, I'm delighted to hear that.
And Melissa, where can listeners find you?
You can find me at Lissa Punch on Twitter and Instagram, and you can also find me on the Talking Comics podcast.
How about you, Sierra?
I'm at Sierra Hauk, and my website is sierrahauk.com.
And I am Jackie the Robot on Twitter and Instagram. And thanks for joining us.